This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have three bills, and we have to be done by about 2 o'clock because of session. So I don't think it should take that long, though, if things move quickly. So with that, Senator Lurie, you got the first responders bill.
Well, I've learned my lesson already this session, assuring people of a brief hearing, but it should be, I would think. We have a bill for EMS operators that will be of particular help in greater Minnesota, where one of the biggest problems we face is recruitment and retention. And it has to do with who's allowed to operate the ambulance and who is required to be in the back with the patient needing care that is that the ambulance is hauling around. So, I mean, I think I'll just probably let Buck, and I also have Jim Reiber, the chair of the EMS Regional Board here. We have an author's amendment to offer before we get started. We
Senator had Lurie initial. Moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, 1-0.
Thank you. We had an initial bill drafted and had a little bit of discussions, and now we have a similar bill that still allows greater flexibility for our EMS friends across the state that, again, have severe troubles with recruitment and retention, and this should go a long ways towards helping them staff in still a responsible and safe manner the ambulances in Minnesota. So, Buck, if you want
to... Mr. McAlpin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Marty and members. For the record, my name is Buck McAlpin. I'm the president of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. Thank you for hearing this bill. Senator Lurie's right. We worked with folks from the EMS Regulatory Board and some of our other legislative committees and ambulance providers and came up with a better piece of legislation, we feel, after our initial bill was introduced. As Senator Lurie stated, we continue to still have lots of hardship in rural Minnesota staffing ambulances, not only second, third trucks, but the primary ambulance. What this does is it allows the ambulance service in rural Minnesota, say their first ambulance has to be staffed by an EMT, emergency medical technician or a paramedic, or two EMTs. If they couldn't meet that staffing model, they could apply to the state EMS regulatory board that Mr. Reiber is the chair of for a hardship variance. And also for second, third, fourth ambulances, it allows a first responder driver to supplement as one of the crew members in the configuration. What we find in rural Minnesota is the fire department may have 30 certified first responders who take 48 hours of training. The EMT training is 120. And our thoughts pretty clear when we've held our 8 outreach meetings around the state with legislators and with ambulance providers and first responders is we would rather have the first responder driver show up and drive the paramedic and EMT than have nobody respond at all. And I think you're all aware of the horrific incident that happened in Cottonwood yesterday afternoon. I work with North Memorial. We operate the ambulance service in Marshland, Redwood Falls. What was a horrific incident, actually, there were some things that happened at that was beneficial. There was a large driving program taking place in Redwood Falls yesterday. So we had some extra ambulances in the area from the metro and advanced life support staff, so we actually had a good response to that call. I talked to the ambulance director from Cottonwood this morning to offer any help we could offer from our association, and we talked about this exact bill. I asked if I could bring this up today. He said we had so many patients that we took firefighter first responders that worked for the city and were trained and drove the ambulance. That is the primary goal with this bill, is to be sure when you're traveling through Minnesota, whether you're a visitor or a resident, that if you have an accident or suffer an illness and you call 911, we need to be sure an ambulance gets to your home or your accident site. And that's all the bill does, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? If not, go ahead.
Hello. Again, my name is Jim Reiber. I'm the chair of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, and also I'm ambulance. I'm director of operations for the ambulance in Pearl, Minnesota. But this bill has been something that the legislative chair of the regulatory board, myself, have worked with the MAA to kind of come up with some consensus language that we feel will be very beneficial for providing ambulance service in Minnesota. We have scheduled the entire board has not seen this, so the board has not taken a position for or against the bill yet. But we are meeting at 1 o'clock today. That's big with a three-day requirement for a meeting rule. That's early so I can get a meeting scheduled. We'll review it. The state medical director has reviewed it, and again, along with the legislative chair and myself, we all feel this is very good, positive language. The other part I want to share, just because I operate an ambulance service in Perham, Minnesota, we commute about 3,000 people. This is the type of thing that we use on a regular basis, or could use. I can go on with numerous examples, but we go to car accidents with ambulances. We'll put critical patients in one and leave an EMT in the second one and have the fireman drive it in. Also, during the weekdays, we staff one ambulance. So if that ambulance is on a call, this happened a couple weeks ago, I may go on the second call, and I'm waiting for an EMT to show up. A couple weeks ago, we had a call with a chest pain patient. I'm three blocks in the hospital, and legally, the four firemen or the two police officers that are all first responders, they couldn't drive me. I had to wait 15 minutes for another EMT from out of town to come in and drive me to three blocks to get to the hospital. So this would eliminate those type of problems that we face it every day in the rural areas with staffing, with recruitment and retention. Of the 14 or so EMTs on the ambulance service that I have now, only two of them can get away during the daytime to respond to calls if they're not busy at the jobs they have. So this gives us, in our service, the 32 firemen that we have are all employees of the city, insured by the city, covered by the same workman's comp as all of my ambulance staff. So that gives me the option of 30-some more drivers to help fill the need. And the people that are going to provide the care, the requirements for them have not changed a bit. So thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to comment on the bill? Are there any questions from the committee? If not, Senator Laurie moves that Senate File 2377 as amended be recommended pass.
Yes.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Cord. Thank you very much. Senate File 2418.
Okay. Jim, did you already introduce yourself?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and committee, thanks for letting us have this bill heard today. We've got before us Senate File 2418, and Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment to this bill.
Senator Coring, that's the A1 amendment.
Is it in here?
Senator Coring moves the A1 amendment. This is the author's amendment to put the bill in the shape you want it. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize for that. I just went down to get a sandwich, and I'm not organized. Is the amendment in here?
You may not have.
Okay, we'll make sure you get the A1.
Can I get the A1 amendment?
Just go ahead with the rest of the bill first, then.
Okay. Yep. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you. What this is currently the EMS board members may serve a four-year term. This language will allow them to be reappointed by the governor to a second four-year term. Now, I think that's a good idea anyway. I'm going to speak for myself. I'm in my second term, and I'm still trying my best to get the lay of the land at this place. And so, somebody that serves 4 years, they just start to try to figure out what to do, and all of a sudden they're out. So I think this is a good idea to have a second term. It's up to the governor. And this bill is supported by the State EMS Regulatory Board and the Minnesota Ambulance Association. We've got Buck McKelkin, President of the Ambulance Association here. Emergency medical services industry is a confusing business to understand. And once a board member understands their job, they are replaced at the end of 4 years. Also, the board has been in existence since 1996, and at times, for certain board positions, applicants are tough to find. And so, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for any questions. As far as the bill is concerned, it's pretty straightforward. We just want to have an extra term for the board members. Buck, do you want to comment on this at all?
Just quick, Mr. Chair, members.
We've
worked with the regulatory board on this for a few different sessions and decided this was a year we'd move this forward as we look at some of our dwindling members that may apply for the 16-member state EMS board.
Senator Coring, following your line of reasoning, I'm wondering how you feel about third terms.
You mean for me?
He's hoping for
well, you know, I guess yeah, you're just joking, but I still just think it makes sense. You know, once, you know, if somebody serves 4 years, I see nothing wrong with serving another 4 years. So I guess we'll have to address that later on, Senator Loring.
Senator Coring, on that point, I think I talked with either you or Senator Kubley about when we had this bill, Senator Wergen, a couple of years ago, why we didn't just repeal the sunset, the term limit altogether. Mm-hmm. There aren't that many people who want to serve on it that many times, and the governor chooses anyway. Was there a reason? Did the board object to making it more than two terms?
We didn't, Mr. Chair and committee, we didn't have any discussion on that. The what was presented to us was just to bring forth the four-year extension. Part of the preliminary process when this was put in place way back goes to they wanted to limit the 4 years to get more EMS involvement and more people involved and more input. Part of what we're finding is that half the board changes every 2 years, so we're not able to maintain the depth. I could ask the board when we go back to our meeting this afternoon if there's interest in having it repealed altogether.
Okay. Senator Lori?
Well, I would make an amendment that we do just strike the need to restrict it to two. And I guess that would require striking lines 215 and 216.
Senator Coring, what do you feel about that?
I would accept that as a friendly amendment. Actually, I think it's a good idea.
Senator Lori moves to delete lines 15 and 16 on page 2. Is there any discussion of that? Is there anyone who wanted to speak with opposition to that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I guess I'd like to, we'd like to talk about the amendment. All it is striking 2009 and replacing it with 2010. Mr. McKell can comment on that, if he would, on why we want to do that.
Mr. Chair and members, this is the statewide trauma system, I believe it's 3 or 4 years ago now, was enacted by the state legislature. As the statewide trauma system is developing and we move it out, we still need to do some work with our ambulance services, mostly in the rural area, as hospitals designate their 2, 3, or 4 level status in outstate Minnesota. And we felt from the Ambulance Association that this would not be ready for us by the 2009 date, so we requested and worked with the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care that oversees the statewide trauma system and their leadership that we move the date out 1 year to 2010 for the implementation date.
And Mr. Chairman, another thing, and I'm sure that we're all aware of it, and I just was informed this morning by Mr. McKelkin that of the accident that occurred. And I guess I'd like to, you to just to talk just for a minute or two about this accident that occurred and all the, the quick response and what happened. I just think it's tremendous on how the ambulances responded. They had six or seven helicopters. So if you could just talk about that.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair and members, that's what we had talked about when Senator Coring was getting lunch.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Okay.
But, yes, we have an excellent system in the state that responds. Very unique that we had about 5 helicopters respond to that incident. We've got a very nice infrastructure. The Ambulance Association, along with the EMS Regulatory Board, works very closely with the Statewide Trauma Advisory Council to make sure we have these type of resources available. The Statewide Trauma System is an excellent system, and it's going to save lives as we build this out in the future and make a model that's inclusive for everybody.
Thank you. Senator Coring, you must have had too long of a lunch. You missed a lot.
Yeah, I know, and I'm sorry. I apologize for that. Mr. Chairman, if there's no...
Senator Lori.
I guess one technical thing. I guess the D on line 217 would need to be changed to C as well.
Senator Lori moves that technical change to his previous amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Just Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Recently, the Public Safety Budget Division had a presentation by the EMS folks, especially the Hennepin County folks who worked at the collapsed bridge site. And maybe if we have a part of a hearing someday where we don't know what to put in it, Mr. Chair, a presentation like that would be so educational for everybody in this committee to see the work that was done there by the EMS folks. And we've heard a lot from the police and fire and the emergency management folks, but kind of the people who seem to have been forgotten in all of our thank yous was the EMS folks who were there. And they came from far and wide, and they did great work, and I want to thank you publicly for that.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Senator Higgins.
And while you're here, I got a question about the medical transportation MTM broker that we banned, we thought, last year, and the administration rechanged what they were doing. Has that been resolved now?
They don't have a job anymore.
Mr. Chair and members, the hospital discharge stuff and the patient flow, as of February 1st, the Department of Health amended the contract with MTM, and it has resolved our problems. And I think the Hospital Association was involved with that, and we have noticed a flawless transition since Commissioner Osberg and the folks at DHS has changed that for us.
Further discussion on Senate File 2418. If not, Senator Coring moves Senate File 2418 as amended be recommended to pass.
Then, Mr. Chairman, would that be sent directly to the floor then?
I believe so. I don't think anybody else has requested it.
No?
Terrific. Thank you.
It's in the tax committee.
Where?
To the floor.
Floor. Go directly to the floor.
Bless you. Excuse me. Is everyone awake now?
The tax committee?
Yeah. Tax? No, no, not taxes.
On the Coring motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Berglund.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Senator Berglund, Senate File 2667. Welcome to the committee for you and Senator Salzman. I guess you both worked on this last year as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. You will remember that last year we had concerns about the direction the state was going in regard to radiation therapy facilities, and tried a number of different ideas to maybe solve it, and came to the conclusion that we weren't going to really solve it, so we put a two-year moratorium in place so that we could have a chance to study the issue further. And we do have a study that was done by Oncology Solutions that we've put in your packet. The study was based on self-reported information from various hospitals that have radiation oncology facilities and what the utilization of their facilities are. And I've made a copy of that for you. And we have a couple on here that are got question marks because they've just come on so recently, or they haven't quite come on yet, that we don't know exactly what their utilization is. But based on what we see across both the 7-county metro area and the 14-county metro area, it seems pretty clear to us that we are at overcapacity today. And the report suggests that we will be at overcapacity through the year 2015. And the report further suggests that new machines that will replace older machines are going to be more efficient and require less time be spent in the facility by the patient. And therefore, by 2015, we probably will have 20% more capacity with the existing facilities than we do today. And so it's for that reason that that I have brought the bill forward to change the two-year moratorium to a permanent moratorium on the construction of new radiation facilities.
Senator Salzman.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be before this committee again. I'm not here very often. This is a policy bill. It's not about specific situation. It truly is about doing what is best for Minnesota. I have looked at the important work that all of you have done over the interim on health care reform and looking at cost containment. This is a good bill because when you look at the capacity issues and looking at the use of the facilities, I think it's very important. But to speak directly to the situation in Woodbury where there has been a number there has been a project proposed with a hospital outside of our community, although a hospital that, you know, also has a number of care providers, being involved with a radiation facility, the local hospitals have not been involved. And we are very fortunate in my Senate district to have two hospitals, one by just a block, but I have two local hospitals, Woodwinds and also the Lakeview Hospital in Stillwater. This morning, I just by, you know, happened to be scheduled to have a tour of the oncology center at United Hospital, and they provide tremendous care, wonderful care. It's just incredible what happens there. This is a program we are very fortunate to have, in the East Metro area. But the proposed radiation facility is probably 10 miles from this facility. I also hear stories about people who are located in greater Minnesota, and heard a story today about, you know, a man who is going to have to come back to St. Paul to get the kind of care that he needs to be able to have that. And so you're talking about a two-hour drive and what he's going to have to go through that. So here we look at Woodbury, and we're talking about a 10-minute drive to get a little closer to a, you know, like the same facility. So this, I did talk with the Lakeview Hospital just a couple minutes ago because I know we talked about, you know, collaboration. And if both these hospitals continue to support a moratorium and to extend it and to make it permanent, and both of the hospitals totally support that. And Jeff Robertson, who is the CEO of Lakeview, I think put it best. He said, by making this permanent, it is going to make the hospital players come to the table and work on a joint facility, perhaps as it is needed in the future. And that's the local hospitals talking. And I think that that's very, very important to look at this as the original intent of this law was to look at working with the local hospital to develop these kinds of like, you know, facilities. Mr. Robertson also noted to me, he said, you know, if this moratorium is listed, it's not just about one group coming in. He mentioned a group of Anderson Consulting or Anderson Cancer Operations could also come into this state and build across from Lakeview Hospital. So it's not just about one particular practice. It's really about what is happening and how do we contain costs, what is reasonable, what is balanced. And I think that this proposal is very reasonable, and I ask for your support.
Thank you very much. I had a question about the chart on capacity. When you have expensive facilities like MRIs, they often work 20 hours a week, 20 hours a day kind of thing. Why with radiation therapy? I mean, I know in both cases people going to them are often very sick, but I mean, I've used MRIs at 5 in the morning kind of thing, and I just was curious.
There wouldn't need to be a restriction to the number of hours that the study used. You could have another hour in the morning and another hour in the afternoon added to the schedule, and then the capacity would be even greater. I think the reason that doesn't happen today is because we are overbuilt and we don't have the patient volume to support additional hours. But in the future, if we did need to, that would be another option for expanding our capacity within our existing facilities.
Denberg, I think that's just another argument for the bill. Only reason I was mentioning that was when you see 90% at one, 95% another, it might make people afraid we're going to fill up and be over capacity. But
well,
capacity is very flexible in that way, not only the way you mentioned about more efficiency. But
right, but when you look at those facilities, there are other facilities nearby them that are at much
I
lower
understand.
Capacity.
I agree with
so.
You. Yeah.
Okay.
Is there anybody who wished to speak?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
I have a question. Does this study look at the distribution of radiation facilities in the state? Last year when we were addressing the issue, there was question about some areas of the state where there is not there may be a need for facilities.
It looked at both issues. And as Senator Salzman says, within either the 14-county or 7-county metropolitan area, we are covered.
So,
and so it's just a matter of, you know, whether you're going to drive 10 minutes or 15 minutes or 20 minutes, which, you know, for an expensive procedure is not unusual to have to do that. Everybody isn't going to have one on the corner.
So, Mr. Chair,
sir.
Senator Berglund, this applies only to the metro counties. Is that
and
correct?
St. Louis.
And St. Louis.
Right.
Yeah, broader and metro.
I think some of these facilities
are really broad metro.
This is the same as last year.
Yes, you were included last year at your request.
The bill.
And if you look at the bill, they have looked at the St. Louis County area also. And they have found that they do not have any shortage of treatment facilities there.
Are there people who are wishing to speak? Did you have any witnesses, first of all?
No, not unless there are questions.
Senator Lynch, and then we'll see if there are opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and senators. Thank you for bringing this forward. And just to members of the committee in particular, I just want to point out how nicely, and it's certainly not an accident, Senator Berglund, but how nicely this bill fits in with the work of the Healthcare Access Commission and with the Governor's Transformation Task Force. And we have had lots of discussion about making decisions that are evidence-based. We've had lots of discussions about cost containment strategies, and we've had discussions on what is deemed as this medical arms race. And so I am appreciative of seeing this legislation brought forward, and would just suggest to members who might not be tied in as closely to some of the many, many hours that the Healthcare Access Commission has been meeting, this does fit in nicely with that.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. I think that's a good point. Is there somebody in the audience, anyone who wished to testify against or with concerns about the bill? Ms. Bray is welcome to. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare, and we're a free market organization. We support patient and doctor freedom, medical innovation, and the right to a confidential patient-doctor relationship. In 2003, we listened as the Minnesota Hospital Association argued for this moratorium, saying that radiation therapy facilities, essentially specialty care centers, cancer centers, quote, weakened hospitals by removing core services to other locations, end quote. In other words, self-contained all-in-one cancer care centers took away their business because patients chose these centers and patients preferred them. There are at least three good reasons to give freestanding cancer care and radiation therapy facilities the opportunity and the right to thrive independently in Minnesota. The first one is fairness. Hospitals are spending millions of dollars to expand their facilities while requesting that you prohibit establishment or expansion of these specialized competitors. Last year, the Hospital Association said the following in a letter supporting the moratorium. Quote, it is appropriate to pause in the development of these very expensive facilities while we assess the needs of our communities, end quote. Now consider what's taking place with metropolitan hospitals. With specialty centers prohibited from expansion, St. John's Hospital is adding an $81 million expansion that includes a new cancer center. Regions is spending $179 million on their expansion, which includes a 10-story patient tower. Stillwater Lakeview is in the midst of a $65 million redevelopment that includes a women's center. $300 million was used to expand the Children's Hospital and Clinic of Minnesota. And Hennepin County Medical Center is renovating at about $80 million. I do have a handout with some of these figures for you.
We'll get that distributed.
CCHC is not opposed to facility improvement or expansion, but this prohibition against construction by the hospital's competitors seems quite unjust to doctors, specialty centers, and the patients who want to use them. The second point is cost of care. When you think of how costs could be reduced by specialty centers with radiology therapy services, consider the impact of MinuteClinic. According to a 2006 Health Partners study, the total costs at MinuteClinic were 25% less than care provided at doctor's offices or urgent care clinics. To compete with MinuteClinic, Priority Pediatrics has just popped up. Patients choose MinuteClinic because of cost and convenience, something that causes patients to migrate to specialty centers as well. Hospitals are already competing with MinuteClinic. There's no telling what could happen to costs if hospitals were required to compete for the preference and price points of patients in the full range of services. The patient is the third thing to think about here. And when you think about the patient, think ease and disease. The elderly are here. The baby boomers are coming. Have you ever walked into one of these huge mega hospitals recently? Often you have to drive into a ramp, walk through the ramp, down the elevator, into the hotel-sized lobby, up the elevator, and down a maze of corridors. It's like going to a university when you're sick or injured or disabled and being forced to walk all the way across the campus. And indeed, they call these their facilities a campus. At the specialty centers, there's usually a parking lot, a readily accessible door, and the receptionist may even know your name. That's patient care. Now, secondly, think disease. There are lots of germs in hospitals. This has become a very big thing in the media recently. A specialty center is not immune to infectious disease but with a focused specialty treatment center and without an ER, the exposure of patients to outside disease is less, an important added protection for patients during cancer therapy when their immune systems are suppressed. Patients want change. People want change. As you consider this debate, realize that the hospital-centered healthcare system is essentially a 20th century model of care. Granting hospitals protected status through a moratorium effectively gives them a corner on the market of care, and there is a market. Preventing patients from moving into a 21st century model of care where patients have a full range of choices. Until hospitals are forced by the free and open market to compete, we'll never know exactly how low the price could go or how good the care could get. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Questions from the committee. Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brace, I wanted to ask you a couple of points. One is on the choice matter here, especially in regards to this issue. I believe that a referral is necessary to go to these clinics. Is that correct? And does that really give the consumer or the patient a choice in this matter?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, I don't know that a referral is always necessary, and a lot of people have choices through their HSA or through their model of insurance where they don't need to get a referral. Oftentimes, it used to be that you had to get a referral for almost everything, specialty-wise. Now, if what happens is that a specialty center comes up here and testifies that, yes, they always have to have referrals, I guess I would be very surprised.
And Mr. Chair, I got one follow-up question, and this would be for Senator Berglund. If we found that there was a need, needed to expand our capacity, wouldn't we be able to have the group be able to petition the legislature for an exception to the moratorium?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, yes. I haven't built that in because it's so far out into the future. I mean, we're talking, you know, easily way over 10 years. But when and if we get to that point, then we would certainly talk about some kind of an exception process. Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd just like to say that this is about not having to pay for these very, very expensive facilities in a larger quantity than we actually need them to serve our population. This particular type of care is not like a minute clinic. You don't open it up in a storefront with a nurse practitioner. These are very, very expensive facilities. They have to have 5-foot thick walls. So we are talking about having to pay for any excess capacity that we have. And clearly we have excess capacity now to think about lifting or allowing exceptions to the moratorium at this point in time would just increase our excess capacity, and I believe would thereby increase our costs.
Senator Salzman.
Right. And that point, onto that same point, Mr. Chair, our visit this morning when we were visiting the Oncology Center and the Cancer Center, I asked, well, how long is the wait to get in? You can come in the same day. Now, how many of us can call up our physician and say, I can get in the same day? So at a 57% capacity, which is on this note, now this morning I heard it was a 75% capacity, and the facility operates from 7:30 in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, could easily increase capacity by being open until 5. So, again, it may be staffing differences. In terms of parking issues, I was on staff at the U of M Hospital for a number of years, and when the Masonic Hospital was trying to serve its, you know, patients better, the issue was how can we provide parking closer to the building to have a separate entrance so that patients who are coming in for radiation or else oncology can come and go easier. And at the U of M, they were able to do that, and I'm not sure what the situation is like, you know, today, but again, to be responsive, you know, to, like, you know, consumers and patients, I think that's something that every hospital is going to do. If we think that we should be lifting a moratorium so that because people want better parking, then that's a whole other discussion.
Further question, Senator Pettinger-Solan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a comment in general, and that, and anybody could respond who wishes to, but I have in general supported the siting and placement of facilities that support the hospital, because when you take them away from the hospital, then the higher cost services are taken away from the hospital, which provides a number of cost losers for the hospital. And so they need a broad range of services in order to be able to operate and be a full service hospital. But I become concerned if in any way our legislation cuts out competition or provides better incentive for one, I mean, better opportunity for one provider over another provider. And I agree with you that we need to get a handle on cutting the cost of high-priced equipment in our state and the mix that creates in the cost of our healthcare delivery system. So there are a number of factors, I just want us to make certain that what we aren't doing is cutting out the opportunity for the best providers to come in and deliver services.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pettinger-Solan, I thank you for that comment. My concern is that this will cut out the competition. And when I look at the numbers in the report that came from Oncology Services or Oncology Center or whatever that was, my concern is that numbers are numbers, but numbers do not necessarily meet the needs of patients. They don't necessarily meet the time or the distance. And I'll just tell you the smallest little thing that happened to me. I was driving behind someone who was weaving and almost running into the cars on the other side and then almost running off the road. And I finally got alongside this person, and I honked my horn, and she wouldn't look at me. And I honked it, and I honked it, and finally I laid on the horn. Because I'm thinking, you are drunk, right? And so she opens up her window, and she looks down at me, and I said, are you okay? And she said, oh, she was sleeping at the wheel. That's what she was saying. She said, oh, I had to drive. I'm driving back from cancer therapy, and if we take these facilities and we say, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, you've got access to care, there is the possibility that services could be set up to be closer to patients, to meet the needs of patients. And numbers on a sheet don't necessarily, just because you've got 80%, 90%, doesn't necessarily mean you meet the capacity or the needs or the individual differences of the patients. Thank you.
Senator Berglund and Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chairman, if a patient is so ill that they should be having transportation provided for them, we should do that. Mm-hmm. But these are so expensive, we really can't afford to be building more than we need. And I would maintain that not only do patients not have any trouble getting in, every oncologist who wants to provide treatment has plenty of places and choices to practice at, so that we're not keeping anybody out and we're not stifling competition. I think if we are successful in getting payment reform to go through, having overcapacity is not going to be an advantage for a provider, because their costs are going to be higher than they should be.
We have one more witness who wanted to testify, and Senator Higgins, well, he's coming up.
Mr. Chair, I had a question for Ms. Reese. If I understood, I just wanted to know whether I understood your testimony correctly. I believe you said that people shouldn't go to hospitals for their treatment because there are sick people there. And I'm just wondering if that's really what you meant. And they have germs and diseases and things.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, that's not exactly how I said it. But
no, but that's what I think you meant.
What I meant is there is a problem. There is a problem with disease in hospitals, and a lot of people don't think about that, but really the most probably germ-laden place that you can find yourself is in a hospital. And when the old St. Paul Children's, I was an ER nurse at St. Paul Children's, when the old St. Paul Children's was torn down, they thought that they could just turn it into, it wasn't torn down, they thought they could just turn it into condos, right? But they found germs all the way down to the very steel. They had to gut it completely. And so there is, and the whole thing with MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, all of this germ thing is becoming bigger and bigger, and sometimes the greatest danger for a patient is not the surgery that they have, but the disease that can get in the wound. So I'm just saying that people with cancer are immune-suppressed, and it is indeed better for them to be in a place where there are less germs to come into contact with.
Okay. Sir, you have one more witness we have. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to this issue. I apologize for my voice here today, but pardon me. I am Dr. Tom Flynn from Minnesota Oncology Hematology, president of that practice. We are a group of 41 cancer specialists providing care at 8 sites here in the greater metropolitan area. I've been practicing oncology in Minnesota for over 25 years. I actually have 2 handouts, if somebody would be kind enough to distribute those, one of which summarizes our practice, and on the back of that sheet, some concerns that we have around the moratorium. I also have a letter from the Minnesota Medical Association, who is opposing this extension of the moratorium as well. As I've told this committee before, we believe that the best model of cancer care delivery is an integrated model of care that involves combining both medical and radiation oncology in one facility. It promotes better coordination of the care and providing all the services under one roof with chemotherapy, radiation, imaging, and often pharmacy. All the personnel in that facility are focused on the needs of the cancer patient, which isn't always the case if you are in a large metropolitan hospital. To the concerns regarding taking services away from hospitals, there is existing legislation, as you all are, I'm sure, aware, that requires that any new radiation facility would be constructed by a hospital or in partnership with a hospital. So to Senator Saltzman's comment earlier from the Lakeview Hospital president, an outside entity would not be able to come in and build across the street. We are fully in support of this legislation and partnering with hospitals. And in fact, United Hospital, the center that Senator Saltzman visited this morning, is a partnership between United Hospital and my practice, MOPA. This is a 50-50 partnership that takes advantage of the expertise of the hospital administration and medical leaders working with our cancer specialists to provide the best possible care while avoiding duplicating services and unnecessary costs. We are fully committed to these partnerships, as I've said, and are in the process of combining our medical and GYN oncology practices that are on the fourth floor of that building into a fully integrated center with the radiation facility on the first floor. We also partner with hospitals in Faribault and Northfield to bring state-of-the-art cancer care to these communities, and our physicians serve on the medical staffs of Alina, Fairview, and Health East hospitals, admitting patients and providing consultative services 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I would respectfully remind you that this current moratorium was not discussed last session as a separate bill, but was inserted into omnibus legislation. And the question I would ask is, if we make this moratorium permanent, how are we going to decide when communities like Washington County need services, and how would they gain access to these in the future? At MOPA, we practice evidence-based medicine using well-developed clinical pathways to assure the best possible care for our patients and the appropriate application of new technology. To my mind, this is about patient access and choice. Patients that we see who need radiation are sent to the facility that they prefer and is most convenient for them to access the care. But I'm very concerned that a moratorium on new facilities will provide for less competition and thereby less impetus to update to the latest technology for the betterment of patient care and outcomes. We've seen dramatic advances in our abilities to deliver cancer care overall, and particularly in the area of radiation, new technologies which allow much better focused therapy with fewer side effects. If there is no competition, there will be a tendency, I believe, to continue with whatever technology is currently there, which is not for the best benefit of our patients. To the capacity issue, I've not had the opportunity to review the study that was referenced earlier, and so I have no idea what methodology was utilized. But I would point out that it is not simply a number game, that an arbitrary assignment of what the capacity of a particular unit should be is not entirely applicable across the board. Some of the newer radiation technologies, which are more effective and less toxic for patients, require more time to administer for each treatment each day. Patients are coming in often 25 or 35 times for radiation therapy, which is, again, speaks to the issue of access, convenience, and availability. And finally, to increase capacity and be doing radiation therapy at 5 o'clock in the morning, like you might be able to do with an MRI scanner, is not realistic for a number of reasons. One, these are very complicated machines. They do not run always like clockwork. There is downtime. There is maintenance time. There's also personnel issues. Radiation technologists, the radiation therapists who actually administer the radiation, are in short supply. And so it's not simply a matter of adding hours because the personnel aren't there to do it. And finally, you have to have physicians on site when radiation is being delivered, unlike imaging centers where there's a much more flexible approach. To the issue of same-day service, I don't think that is an indication of excess capacity. That's an indication of the dedication of individuals who are taking care of cancer patients and making themselves available so that the patients can be cared for in a very timely manner. So in conclusion, again, I would say this is ultimately about patient convenience, better outcomes for those patients, better coordination of their care, and the abilities to advance technology to better therapies that will improve the results for the people that we take care of. Thank you very much.
Dr. Flynn, when you said a minute ago that, what would people in Washington County do if they needed, how would they access the system if they needed more capacity? I sort of think that we're hearing an awful lot from some clinics when we don't need them. I have a feeling that they can be very vocal when they really do need one, too. I really, MOPA and others have been around here very, very frequently, and I just have trouble believing somebody couldn't get the word out to us that there was a shortage if there was one. And also, we did discuss this, even though it was folded into an omnibus bill. We had a thorough discussion in this committee, I think, last year.
Right.
I'm pretty sure we did, anyway. Senator Flynn, Senator Saltzman.
Senator, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to assure Dr. Flynn that if I ever perceive that people in my community did not have access to oncology services, I would be the first one at this table. And I would also like to invite the three hospitals that are in the East Metro area, or four, to come to the table and discuss this issue, that if there is a possibility, because if I'm reading the last paragraph on page 1 from the MMA correctly, collaborative models of expansion should be explored, entering into joint ventures with separately owned facilities, that we should explore opportunities to work together. Absolutely. But in the proposal brought forward last year, that was not the case. The local hospitals, the hospitals that serve this community, were not at the table. If you want to talk about competition, they were not at the table. And once that facility is developed, they're sort of out of the market. So I would welcome the opportunity. I've worked with, you know, people in my community on many other issues. And, in fact, I will call for that meeting to try to get, like, to bring these people together. I, in fact, suggested that today during my visit, which just coincidentally happened to happen today, was not planned. I was invited to come. And I asked specifically what is going on behind the scenes to address this issue, because a lot of it is how are the local hospitals involved. And I was not hearing that there were negotiations or even a willingness to work with some of the local hospitals. That was disappointing to me. I would like to change that, and I'd like to hold all the hospitals responsible for coming to the table. This is not about one entity or one group. It's about everyone who's a stakeholder being at the table to address this issue.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, just to respond to the doctor's comments, this bill last year was passed by the Senate as a separate bill. It was later that the House incorporated it into the omnibus bill, and then it was passed as a part of the omnibus bill as its final passage. But this bill was not, you know, in the dark of the night tucked into a conference committee. It was passed as a separate bill on the floor of the Senate. And members, you know, some people like to make this be an issue about doctors' groups fighting with each other. I don't view it that way. I view it as we have a lot of different provider groups out there now that we did allow more facilities to be built in conjunction with hospitals. But they were all very good at it. And now we have enough. We have enough for a long time. And so for me, it's about spending money on expensive facilities and driving up healthcare costs when it isn't necessary. And so I ask you to support this bill.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a couple of questions. I guess first, just with respect to the passage of this bill, my recollection in looking at the record of the Senate is that we adopted the moratorium on the floor of the Senate in April as an amendment offered by Senator Berglund on the floor, and I don't recall that we discussed the moratorium and adopted it into language in this committee last year, and I could be wrong on that, but that was the it was adopted on the floor as a floor amendment. And I guess that's one of my questions. We did that last April, and it was a two-year moratorium that was described as a compromise on this issue, and now we're less than a year away from that, and we're saying that we ought to do away with that compromise and impose a permanent moratorium. And I'm just wondering why we wouldn't at least want to wait for the duration of the moratorium to expire and have another discussion of this in a more, expansive way. Yes, as I listen to the discussion, and I know we've talked about other health care issues in this committee and in the legislature, and there's a lot of talk about whether we want to have a government-run system or a privately-run system, and most people say, no, we don't want a government-run system, but here we are, we're sitting around here today, and we're talking about we believe that there's too much capacity. We don't want to do this. If people want to have more, they ought to come to us and petition for more. And I'm thinking, well, that makes it seem as if we're running this system, that we say we don't want to have this cost. And the question is, who's going to pay for that cost? Well, if we're saying that the public is going to pay for it, that implies that we're going to have a government-run system entirely. I'm not sure that I certainly, as an individual, don't feel competent to assess the capacity of medical procedures in the marketplace. And I would think that individual doctors and practices, as they look at investing in technologies and facilities, that they are certainly going to understand and try to anticipate what the capacity demands are. And I think they would have a direct interest financially and whether or not that's a good investment or not, much more so than any interest that we could have. We're not going to suffer financial gain or loss by having a hospital or a facility built or not built, but people who invest in these things would, and to say that they're not concerned about capacity is just, I think, erroneous. So I'm concerned about that general sort of flavor of the discussion that, we as a legislature are the only people competent to decide whether or not there is a need for a facility or for a treatment. I'm struck a little bit by the fact that we don't impose moratoria on other facilities that offer health care. I'm familiar with facilities that do different kinds of surgeries, all kinds of independent standalone clinics that provide health care of different kinds. But we have a moratorium on this one particular kind of service, and I'm wondering if it makes sense to do it in this case. Maybe we should do it in every case. And I guess the last question I might have is that the discussion about if we allow these clinics to flourish or to be governed by market forces, that right now in hospital settings, these are very high cost centers or profit centers for hospitals, and if we allow other people to come in, that they would lose some of that. So what we're saying is we want to guarantee a high-cost procedure to continue to be high-cost so that the hospitals can profit by that. And how are we going to get cost savings when we're putting in place a law that will guarantee and prohibit those high-cost services being dealt with in any other way? What we're saying is that we want to guarantee high-cost radiation treatment to be done in hospitals so that they can continue to make money. That's what seems to be the argument here. I'm not persuaded that a moratorium generally is a good idea, and I'm not sure if I understand why a moratorium for just this procedure makes sense, and I'm not sure I understand why a moratorium that was adopted on the floor last April as a compromise has to be set aside today when it hasn't even expired. And I guess maybe if you want to address those questions and help me to understand this, it doesn't to me make sense that we would do this at this time and in this way without some understanding of the broader issues. And I would argue we should continue with the moratorium as it exists and wait till it expires and then have a more expansive discussion about the virtues of this and whether or not the legislature should be the ones determining what the capacity of radiation treatment should be.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, you may be right. There may be other areas where we have very expensive equipment or procedures where we have an oversupply that we should be looking at. I don't believe we should wait when we know we have an oversupply in this area to address this area. And if you think there's an oversupply in another area, then let's work together on that. The purpose of the two-year moratorium was to give us time to get more information, to do a study of capacity. We've done that now. I didn't know exactly how long it would take. We've done that now. Now that we know that we're at overcapacity, there's no reason to wait any longer to take the next step.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hahn.
And I understand that. I don't recall that that was the argument to adopt the moratorium, is to give us time to do a study of capacity. And it's curious that some of the people that are engaged in the very practice dispute the idea that there is a overcapacity. And again, I think that if the presumption is that the state of Minnesota owns and governs medical procedures in the state and we should decide how much there is to be, then you're right. We have to do that. But I'm not sure that that premise is accepted by everyone, that the state of Minnesota should be the body that decides how much of what kind of health care should be available to people and how it should be administered. I don't think we've gotten to that point yet. I know there are people who want to get us there. I'm not one of them. But we're not there yet. And my question is, if there is a need and there are people providing a need for patients, and it's governed by the willingness of individuals to risk their money to build and maintain these facilities, why wouldn't we say let's permit that and see what maybe the high-cost procedures become less costly over time? It seems to me by putting in a moratorium, all we're going to do is guarantee that these high-cost procedures will remain high-cost. That's the premise of the argument.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I would agree with you if we're just talking about a procedure. But we're not. We're talking about a facility. And the facility in and of itself is very expensive to build. It's expensive to operate, too, but it's very expensive to build. And everybody who builds one has to cover their overhead. And when we build more than we need, what we're talking about is somebody is betting on the fact that they can take market share away from somebody else and leave somebody else with less capacity. It doesn't mean we get a less expensive procedure. We still pay for everything we've built. And that's the point. This is different than, you know, some of the other things. And in the case of other things where we have more procedures being done than we need a different strategy for how to reduce that type of overutilization.
And, Mr. Chairman, just, I guess, a final comment. I know, Senator Berglund, I'm not going to persuade you to, I guess I would prefer to say let's leave it alone, leave the moratorium in place as it is. Let's do some more work on this and let it stand for a while and see if we can do this. But with all respect, I think that the characterization of having competition is not a way to bring costs down, I think, is false. I think that has proven to be, that is how costs are brought down. If some enterprise says we can do this and do it at a lower cost, in the course of doing that, they take the market share, if there is indeed a fixed market share, which typically that isn't necessarily true either. But if they do take more market share, all that means is the consumers benefit by paying lower costs for the procedures, and the other folks have to figure out how to do it cheaper or find some other way to deploy their assets in a more productive way. That's how innovation occurs. That's how things get better. That's how efficiency accrues. When we do things like pass laws forbidding or preserving a monopoly or preserving through government action a cost structure, there is no incentive for anyone to do it differently. And this is what troubles me about this moratorium. I think there is great benefit in looking at ways to find innovation in the marketplace. And this, is to me, is very antithetical to that idea. So, as I said, I know that I'm not going to persuade you to leave in place what we adopted last spring. I would argue we should do that. Let's let the moratorium exist and have some more debate. There may be other studies on capacity that might have different premises or different understandings that might vary from the one that we've seen. But again, my point is we as the legislature don't own this system, and I don't know that we should take it upon ourselves to decide all the details about what gets done and who should do it. There is a marketplace that we should rely on, at least to some degree, and let's not presume that we've destroyed the market yet. We may get there, but we're not there yet. I think we ought to at least use what we have to see if we can find ways to save costs. So that's all I wanted to make my case here for, and if you have anything else you want to respond to. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hatt. I did notice on this sheet here that in St. John's Hospital at 1575 Beam Avenue in Maplewood, there are two linear accelerators with a 50% capacity. In 1580 Beam Avenue, which five house numbers away from it, which means across the street, Maplewood Cancer Center has two linear accelerators. And I would guess, unless St. John's doesn't have any uncompensated care patients, that the fact that they might make some money off this that they can use to pay uncompensated care might be helpful. And it's hard to picture across the street you're giving people more convenient access. But Senator Berglund, is there any more questions? Anybody else in the audience want to speak to the bill? Not Senator Berglund.
No, there's a gentleman.
Oh, there is somebody. I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Irving Lerner, and I'm a medical oncologist who began his medical oncology practice 41 years ago, six blocks from here. I was the first trained medical oncologist to practice in St. Paul. And in addition to having been a medical oncologist, I've been very active with the American Cancer Society. I'm a past president of the Minnesota Division of the American Cancer Society, and I'm currently on the board of the Midwest Division of the American Cancer Society. I'm an adjunct professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota, and I currently serve on the Community Advisory Board for the Cancer Center at the university. And I give you those credentials to make the point for which I am here today, that I have a passion for the well-being of the cancer patient. That's really what I care about. I'm not so much involved in the business interests and a lot of the other points that have been made here today, but I care passionately how cancer patients endure their illness and endure their treatment. I don't know if any of you appreciate how really genuinely ill these people are from their disease, and then at least for a time, the more so, because of the arduous nature of our treatments. And based on that, I'm profoundly interested in their access to medical care. We've heard a lot of discussions about how much facility exists in this community and how far it is and how easy it is to drive just a few minutes more to another facility. But I've had the position of sitting in the chair and talking to cancer patients and saying, I will prescribe for you 6 weeks of 5 days a week of very difficult radiation therapy. And they will look at me and say, 6 weeks, 5 days weekly, it's an enormous burden, but I'll feel better while I get it. And the answer is no, you'll feel worse while you get it. You're sick now, and we're about to make you sicker. And then they look at me and say, where can I have this treatment? Well, I practiced next to United Hospital, where we have a magnificent facility that I'm glad you were able to visit today. And if they lived in that vicinity, they were very blessed and very happy about it. At that time, our choices were United Hospital and St. Joe's and the facility that then existed up at Maplewood. It was a little less complicated then. And we would always offer those patients a choice of where they wanted to be treated, speaking to your issue of choice. Yes, they had a choice if their insurance plan permitted, and I didn't direct them to one place or another. But many times, patients would say to me, those are my only choices. I can't be treated closer to my home, and my home might be on the east side of St. Paul, in the Woodbury area, or even in western Wisconsin. A lot of those patients would have to drive to one of the facilities I've just mentioned. Access to patient care, immediate access when possible, is a paramount interest for these patients. It really does matter to them. Whereas for you and me, it may be very simple to drive an extra 10 minutes, it's not so very simple for these patients who are so sick, many of whom are quite unaccustomed to driving into the big city and don't want to have anything to do with the big city and are looking for places more peripherally. Which is exactly what's being proposed. So that's my first driving interest, but I also want to share with you one other thought. Having been around the block as long as I have, I'm not particularly a great believer in market-driven economics. I don't have any problem with some governmental control of the marketplace at all, personally. But I have seen in these 41 years that I've been involved in the oncology scene in this community that market forces do work. At least they've worked in this community. When I first started in medical practice, we had radiation therapy at St. Joseph's Hospital, and we had radiation therapy at Midway Hospital. And I personally couldn't really understand the Midway Hospital facility because we had a very small number of patients from that area. There wasn't a big marketplace there. I didn't understand why there was radiation there. And the answer is there wasn't a good reason for it, and it dwindled away. And then the next step that caught my interest was when the new Ramsey Hospital was built to take the place of Anchor Hospital, now called Regions, as you know. When the new Ramsey was built, it had a very large radiation therapy facility, but we had a terrific unit at St. Joe's, and I couldn't understand what that was all about. Well, neither could the marketplace. And it did not thrive, and for a number of years, no radiation took place at that facility. And then it had to be totally reconfigured when the marketplace changed. The marketplace does work in this area, and in this area I am persuaded that market forces generate the right outcome. The proposed unit, as it stands right now, is not a casual enterprise. It's the basis of a very sophisticated analysis of community need and resources. And I am absolutely persuaded that there is a current need for this facility, but certainly going forward that need is enormous. And to postpone it, to delay it, is to create one additional barrier to access for care for my cancer patients. And I would ask you not to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? If not, further discussion from the committee? If not, Senator Berglund moves Senate File 2667 as amended.
No, we didn't.
No amendment. Senate File 2667 be recommended to pass, and this doesn't have to go to your committee or anywhere. Be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
With that, we are done. The meeting is adjourned.
Good job. I'm not sure why we have the East Phillips information. This, I think, is Senator Berglund's bill and for another committee.
So we might want to
keep those copies.
Yes, go back, give them back to Shannon or something. Yeah, we make enough copies around here.
Yep.